This is the Paper Planes podcast, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
Ultimately, marketing's about reaching and reading human beings. We've got to measure the right things and actually question what the statistics tell us. If you get into that sweet spot, then it's a really fruitful conversation about how you can drive profitable growth.
Welcome to the Paper Planes podcast, episode number 55. It's going to take me a little bit of time getting used to saying that. So I may keep slipping into the old name, but we have a new name. We have a rebrand. My current business, my digital consultancy, has a rebrand of Paper Planes. So we thought we might as well call this the Paper Planes podcast. So thank you for joining us. Just to get the housekeeping out of the way, please, if you enjoy this episode or if you enjoy any of our episodes, please rate and review us on iTunes. We really would appreciate that. Please also come and find us on Instagram, where we post some of our antics, both from the podcast and from our consultancy. That is flypaperplanes.co. If you want to do your own podcast, if you're interested in starting up a podcast, and I highly recommend it from a content point of view, then you need to speak to our podcast producer. His name is Gilberto, and his website is thepodcastboss.com.au. And finally, if you do want to come and talk to us, which we would love because, you know, we'd like to hear from you. If you're interested in working with us from a business perspective, or you just like to follow us on one of our social media channels, then we've mentioned Instagram. You can find me on LinkedIn. I am Simon Dell. I forgot my LinkedIn address was there. You can find me on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook as Paper Planes, flypaperplanes.co. You can find us on LinkedIn as well, the company page, or if you want to come to the website, which as I speak has not been finished, but you can come there anyway. So that's www.flypaperplanes.co. So that's pretty much it. Now, the podcast guest for today is a gentleman by the name of Rick Navarro. Now, he's based in Melbourne, and he has a CV that is absolutely exceptional. So I'll talk through some of his early stuff. This man is a former journalist. He has worked with the Office of the Prime Minister of Australia when John Howard was the Prime Minister as Media and Communications Manager. He was working on a particular project there. He has been the communications client and media consultant for the Australian Beverages Council. He's worked with the Australian Industry Group, Infrastructure Partnerships Australia, Mining and Energy Services Council of Australia, all these. But for the last almost 9 years, he has been the Global Director of Marketing and Communications for an organization called Norman, Disney and Young. He has been awarded quite a few achievements. He was the CEO Marketing CEO Magazine Marketing Executive of the Year. He's been nominated as a global CMO in the top 40 and the CMO of CMO in top 10 Australia. So pretty significant awards. He's also written a book called Marketing with Purpose. He is a very, very intelligent and insightful man. So I hope you enjoy this interview. Let's jump straight into it with Rick Navarro from Norman, Disney and Young. Thank you. So welcome to the show, Rick Navarro. You are down in Melbourne today. How is sunny Melbourne today? Or is it indeed actually sunny today?
Thanks, Simon. The sun is parting through the clouds as we speak, so it's actually primed to be a good summer's day in Melbourne. So
chances are it'll rain and snow by the end of the day as well.
I can probably promise you that you'll get four seasons indeed.
Just very quickly, I've obviously introduced you prior to this, but give us a little bit about. Give us your elevator pitch that you tell people what you do, who you are when you meet them.
it's really interesting this, because as marketers, we should be so accomplished at doing it for ourselves. So obviously adept at doing it for organizations and for brands. And in fact, some of my colleagues, I'll sit down and I'll do a what's your value proposition exercise and work through that. So for myself, I'm like the painter whose house is never painted. if I was to try and summarize it, I mean, probably a marketing leader with a diverse background. So that looks to, I suppose, intersect marketing with bottom line growth. And I think that's where a lot of marketers, quite honestly, this is where the discussion might end up going today, need to focus on that bottom line growth. So really helping brands grow from the perspective of customer obsession. So for me, it's about addressing customers where they want to be spoken to in a forum that they want to be reached. So I suppose my elevator pitch is helping brands grow by delighting their customers with meaningful, tailored and consistent experiences.
Okay, awesome. What I was going to do, because I looked at your background, I've been through your Twitter, which you haven't updated for a while, so we need to have a talk about
that.
And obviously I want to talk about the role that you've been in for quite a while now with Norman, Disney and Young.
Yeah.
But I actually wanted to touch on three of your earlier roles, because I think they're quite fascinating, and you seem to have put yourself, certainly earlier on, into roles, well, you may not have put yourself into them, but you found yourself in roles that I think would be quite challenging roles, in the sense that you're to me a little bit in the firing line. And I'll start with the obvious one, which is your work with the former Prime Minister John Howard. So you were media and comms manager there.
For a particular initiative, which was during the day, called the Supermarket to Asia initiative. So this was during the time when there was a huge push to take Australian agribusiness and processed foods to the Asian market. So back in the 90s, when there was a magnificent sort of impetus towards supporting our agribusiness and primary producers, but also processed foods. So that was a really interesting time, because the Asian markets were burgeoning. China was just starting to come up on the radar. Japan was still our number one export market. But there were little pockets of opportunities across Southeast Asia, in particular, that the government at the time were looking to capitalize on. So that involved a lot of, as you're probably alluding to, a lot of interesting stakeholder management, in inverted commas.
I imagine that politics in the marketing, politics and marketing is one of those things that kind of jars together quite badly sometimes.
You know what? Ultimately, marketing's about reaching and reading human beings.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of pedigree, and I started as a journalist as well, so I think that ability to understand human behaviour, be relatable as well, and to be able to tell a story are really vital ingredients. And I think we speak about B2B and B2C, but we're really about, I'd like to call it human-to-human marketing, because ultimately that is what we're all in the business of doing. So when I think back to that time, I think it was a really fascinating, interesting and unique breeding ground for a marketer. So in terms of, yes, it may seem like worlds apart, but in fact, there's a lot of skills, attributes and experiences that you can derive from that particular environment that are so relevant in today's, CX laden environment. So from that point of view, it's been a fascinating ride.
Give me something that you probably took out of that experience working in that political arena that sort of helped you, later on in your life.
Well, I think first of all, the initiative that I was working with as part of the Prime Minister's Department was apolitical, so it was seen to be almost like, well, this is an export initiative that we're going to focus on. That said, it's really about understanding human behaviour, and particularly early on in your career, we all strive to find our particular niche. So for me, it was about understanding the way the different characters work, being able to understand and read different environments, but also start to learn how to influence. And I think that that's a really key component of what we all do in our day-to-day lives, whether we're marketers or in any other role, within brands.
You touched earlier that prior to that you'd been a journalist. I'm always fascinated to talk to people who used to be journalists back in the old days, about their perception of the journalism trade and media today and how it's changed. Yes. Do you think there is it feels like someone from me looking from the outside, there's a radical difference between how it used to be back then and how it is today. Is that actually the case?
There are still obviously tremendous pockets of excellent journalism. I think what we've found is that there are now individuals who can post content at any time, and we're all in some ways journalists in inverted commas, when we post on social media, when we post on Twitter, or we don't, as you alluded to earlier. So the craft of journalism is still there. And what's been pleasing for me to see is that a lot of those former journalists have been swept up into corporate roles. So there's a realisation from a lot of brands, savvy brands, that they need good storytellers. And one of the things that journalism, the craft of journalism allows you to do is to actually weave together content. And you know what, from a practical sense, do it to a deadline as well. So there's a lot of pluses that good journalists have actually started to introduce into branding and marketing and within corporate communications, and some have moved into corporate affairs. So I think to your question, journalism has shifted, has changed. We still look at New York Times, Washington Post. In Australia, we've got the Financial Review, which I would hold up as, a premier piece of journalism as well. So I think there are pockets that exist that are still good quality content. And, of course, now the way in which it's consumed is very different too. So, the rivers of gold have disappeared, so the actual model has changed significantly for publishers. But when you get down to it, to the nub of it, it's really about being able to articulate a story, to capture the essence of a story and report on, hopefully, the facts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fantastic point. I don't think that, journalism has necessarily died. I think your point to that it shifted to to perhaps who's paying the journalist now, where it used to be perhaps the independent media outlets, and now they have an opportunity within, corporate areas to tell stories about particular companies and things like that. I think that's, I think that's key.
Yeah, and what's really interesting, Simon, is that today we have vloggers, bloggers, etc. that occupy a lot of the reading time that as individuals we spend. So whether we're on the train, tram, bus, wherever we are travelling, we most likely will be listening to or reading content, often not produced by an official media house. So what that's done is it's opened up and become a very democratised way of reporting. Obviously, some of the, this is a much broader discussion, which we could have a whole podcast series about in itself. Yeah, yeah. But what does that mean about the integrity of reporting, of news, fact-checking, etc.? Because the beast of the media corporation is that anything that's put out there has to be fact-checked. So look, that's the environment we live today. The upside is if you've got a very specialised niche, you're going to find followers.
The third area that I quickly wanted to discuss about your previous your previous roles was the Australian Beverages Council. And the reason that one interests me so much, not just because I came from a background myself of not necessarily soft drinks, but more alcohol drinks, but
yeah,
they again are another brand that perhaps gets that have been fairly well attacked over the last, say, 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
Was that the case? I look at the timelines when you worked in that. Was that the case when you were there, or was that sort of, was that starting, or?
It was, yeah, you've hit it, because it was right at the cusp of the sugar debate.
Yeah.
So there was publicity starting to emerge big time around, well, what are we actually drinking in each bottle or can of soft drink? What does that translate to in, and you had the literal displays of teaspoons of sugar. You had dietitians, nutritionists weighing in on the debate. You had federal government weighing in on the debate. So on the one hand, we're working with some of the largest brands in the world, PepsiCola, Coca-Cola, Amatil, Cadbury, Schweppes, and niche players as well within the Australian market who are trying to position their products. And weighing that up against government pressure and community and stakeholder concerns. So that creates a really interesting working environment for any marketing professional or prom specialist. So what it did do, though, and one of the things that came out of that was, and like marketers, we all look for solutions, is bottled water. So this was at the time when obviously bottled water wasn't new, but it catapulted bottled water into the limelight. So the marketing focus went away from the sugar debate to, well, that's okay, here's an alternative. So I suppose the lesson from that is, as marketers, we can always look at a scenario and say, we have a particular situation here. It's not so much about distraction, but alternatives. So giving consumers choice. So I think that placated a lot of the community concerns, and like most issues, that, pardon the pun, fizzled out. So bottled water was set up. There was even an institute set up, the International Bottled Water Institute, something like that. So it's big business. And today, it in some cases outsells a lot of soft drinks. And now we're seeing the latest trend is for flavoured bottled water or carbonated water drinks. And these are all good choices. And these all come, all of these changes, when you look at the timeline, you know, we're looking at FMCG at the moment, but if you look at many products and services, a lot of it comes out of consumer sentiment. So we're now at a point where we've shifted from huge volumes of carbonated heavy sugar water to what we call healthy alternatives, so zero sugar or no sugar or low sugar alternatives. And they're, I suppose if you were to chart those sales, they're far outpacing the traditional soft drinks and beverages sales. So, and this, again, all comes from consumer sentiment.
If you, from your experience there, and I'm going to imagine that somewhere in your experience with Norman Disney Young, you've dealt with brands that perhaps, or businesses that have a negative perception.
Yeah.
How do you generally talk to brands about approaching those issues? What are some of the things that people out there that could do if there are marketers out there, or the business owners there, that perhaps there is a negativity around their business? What are some of the things that they can do to tackle that?
Well, I think, and this is where in my book, Marketing with Purpose, I talk a lot about clearly the importance of brand purpose. Now, brand purpose has received a lot of airtime and oxygen over the last few years, and for good reason. Because brand purpose should ultimately be the North Star for every organisation. So driving behaviour, driving the ethics and values of an organisation is the brand purpose. So
yep.
if that is in place, that should be the guiding light for the entire C-suite and for the whole executive team. And leadership plays a vital component in brand success. So the attributes, values, and behaviors of your leadership team will cascade down across an entire organization. It's never to be underestimated about the values that a leadership team brings. We only have to look so far as the Banking Royal Commission to see that trust, behavior, and brand performance and perception are all inextricably linked.
Yeah.
Ultimately, hands roll if that is broken. So if you break that consumer trust, that's where brands get into a lot of strife. So to the point about brand purpose, it really is the nucleus of providing the go-to-market strategy. Internal engagement is so important as well. We look at brands that are successful and they'll have fantastic internal engagement scores. Why? Because they feel empowered. They love working for the brand. They understand that they come in to work for a particular reason, for a brand that upholds the highest ethical standards, for example, and that they believe in the products themselves. So my advice simply would be to look at the leadership team, to look at what the brand purpose is, and if it's not well articulated and understood by your own people, that's a big red flag. I think that ultimately will be a guiding light to say, well, on this particular pathway, we need to understand that brand purpose is something we need to get our house in order about.
When you talk about brand purpose, and again, when you work in a big agency, that customers that are coming to you are able to spend budget, time, those kind of things, investigating brand purpose. If you're down at the other end of the spectrum, you're a small business, it might be a family business, you might have anything from 2 to 3 to 4 employees, maybe 10, 20. Discovering those brand purposes is often a bit of a challenge because you just don't have the time and the money. Is there anything that you can suggest, any sort of exercises, any processes that those smaller businesses could go through to actually work out what that brand purpose is?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think we can all get caught up in agency land and hiring experts to do it for us. The first point I would make is brand purpose, and agencies are going to hate me for this, but it should never involve an agency at least at the initial stage. I think it needs to come from within an organisation. It needs to be unpacked from what a brand stands for to its own people. So it's almost working in reverse to create the ultimate outcome. So unpacking that internally is important. For a small business, quite simply, ask your customers. They're the greatest form of input towards what your brand purpose is. Ask them what are the first 2 or 3 words that come to mind when I give you XYZ service or provide you with this particular product. Yeah. You'll find that over time there'll be a consistent pattern there, and all of a sudden you'll end up with a purpose that actually just resonates with you and your customers. It doesn't have to be an expensive exercise. It doesn't have to be a cumbersome exercise. It can just be a conversational one that over time really impacts that. What is the essence, the nut of your brand?
There's a lot of... the obvious thing that sort of springs to the back of my mind is and I know you get different people have different opinions on this book, but Simon Sinek's starting with the why, understanding why businesses do what they do. And whether you like that book or not, it's one of those ones that I think from a small business, if they sat down and just read that to start with, would probably be a good help. Is there anything else that you think from a reading perspective or a learning perspective online that people would be worth gravitating to?
Oh, look, I'm a big fan of Seth Godin as well. So I think I look at all his work and it's very easy to read and understand whether you're a marketer or a small business owner or a marketing leader with a team of 50, it's applicable. he's got a range of books out there. He's a prolific writer. He's got a daily blog. Definitely a big fan of Seth Godin. Importantly, because he does make it real. He does talk in a way that's actually meaningful to a brand, but ultimately always looks at it from the lens of the customer.
Yeah. I think my Seth Godin recommendation would be, I think the first book to go and get would be Purple Cow. I think that's probably that's the defining, the defining Seth Godin book. It's interesting because it's written in a day before social media, and in the early days of the internet.
Yes.
So you kind of have to perhaps reframe it as you read it. But for me, I think Purple Cow is the starting point for any Seth Godin.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at Purple Cow, Linchpin, Poke the Box, or even All Marketers Tell Stories. But they're all great. The storytelling one in particular, you know, by myself, got a lot out of. So there's great content, and as we were talking about earlier, I think, you know, looking online, doing some research. There's some great Australian marketers as well, you know, so we've got some great local talent that I think we can often default to looking at the overseas examples. But you look at the list of, you know, top 50 CMOs, and there's some wonderful marketing talent in there who have done some transformative work themselves. So, you know, again, social media plays an important part in learning those lessons from individuals who have maybe gone through a huge transformation process themselves.
There was when I was going through your Twitter and looking at some of the older stuff that you'd shared, and some of the articles that you passed on, there was one that sort of jumped out at me, because I think this is a major problem in the marketing space, was your comment about marketers getting caught up with the shiny new things versus understanding that traditional marketing still really works well. Talk to me a little bit about that. What are perhaps the shiny new things that, you know, we ought to be aware of?
Okay, so we're going to go down the digital marketing path now. Isn't it interesting that digital, I think if you ask a dozen people what digital means, you'll be close to getting a dozen different responses. But digital for me is a way of working. It's not necessarily, for me it's a verb, it's not necessarily a noun, even though it is. I think we can get caught up in this idea that digital is the panacea, that the company down the road's gone digital, whatever that means. So we need to hurry up and catch up and make sure that we're digital as well. In the race to do that, though, are we focused on our customers? What is it that is important to our customers? So always go back, for me, to what it is that your customers want, how they want to be communicated with, what content do they want to consume, and what's really important to them at the end of the day. Digital are really the enablers. So they enable marketers and other teams to fulfill that customer obsession. So the shiny new toys example was really about some marketing leaders and even the C-suite themselves getting caught up in the fact that we need to implement this particular MarTech solution because that's going to help transform our business. And in some cases, it does. In some cases, you get really short-term, solid results. The problem with that is it's not sustainable because there's no underpinning foundation based on really deep-dive customer research. So that post, if I recall correctly, was really about saying that digital, yes, it's important, but let's not forget traditional marketing in the sense of understanding your customers, understanding what their drivers and needs are. And in today's environment, doing as much listening as you do talking to customers, and this is where voice of customer is so profound and so important today. To me, if I was to talk about digital in the sense of a particular tool in marketing. For me, it would be that voice of customer tools. So doing a lot of listening. That's going to inform your strategy. Yeah.
The kind of lens, that sort of lens leads me to my next question. We're in a point, and I think we've been in a point for a couple of years where, you know, marketing is changing. You know, the basics that you're talking about is understanding what the customer wants still underpins everything, but the channels are changing, the route to talking to the customers is changing. And even today, I think social media is still undergoing this, you know, this change. There's a lot of people leaving Facebook. There's, you know, Twitter's just died on its backside from an engagement perspective. That those channels are fracturing. There's, you know, there's, and I haven't looked at it, but, you know, things like TikTok and, you know, gaming channels where people sort of exist now. So what are your thoughts? And I get that there's still that kind of core thing that we've got to get right with marketing. But from a channel perspective, where do you see all this going to in the next sort of 5 years? What are the new shiny things that perhaps we should be looking at in terms of, you know, overall execution and tactics?
Experience.
Okay.
So what experience, in the commas, are you giving the customers? So there's a lot of talk recently that, you know, experiential marketing. So there are agencies that are dedicated to unpacking that and helping marketers to achieve that for their customers. I see that as a huge growth area. I think sensory experiences, let's not forget, going back to that human-to-human discussion, still dominate. I think we're in a time and place where it's been fantastic, this upsurge of social media channels. What we'll find is that some will come, dominate, and drop off, and potentially even die off. But there'll be a new player in the market. I think ultimately, as an umbrella across all of them, is what experience you provide your customers. And by that I mean an immersive experience. You know, so if you, for example, if you own a golf shop, you know, having customers come in and not only look at golf clubs, but perhaps having them in some sort of AR or VR environment where they can actually test the golf club within the shop. You know, same with a clothing retailer, for example, that's happening already. I think that we're going to see more and more of that. And what that does organically is create advocates and ambassadors. So as a customer, Simon, you've gone in and you've tried this you know, latest 9-iron, if you're a golfer, you're going to talk about the wonderful experience you had because you just knocked that 350 meters. And it was just the best thing ever. So for me, it's about experience.
And it's interesting you say that because one of the exercises I've worked with a client of mine was about a process that I think it was the Airbnb guys went through when they when they started their business, was trying to understand what they call the 11-star experience. And the theory behind that was that any business should be delivering a 5-star experience. That's what they're there to do. You know, for just to, in today's age, survival alone necessitates that you need to deliver a 5-star experience.
Yeah, spot on.
But the Airbnb guys were saying, well, if we are delivering a 5-star experience, let's assume that we've got that right. What does a 6-star experience look like? What does a 7-star experience look like? And they worked that all the way up to an 11-star experience. And I can't for the life, I read this in a book, but I can't for the life of me remember what their 11-star experience was specifically. But I think it was something like staying in an Airbnb that was orbiting the planet while the Beatles were playing for you live. And they went that.
If you like the Beatles.
But I think, so they defined that as their 11-star experience and gone, well, look, obviously we can't make that happen. But what are the elements of an 11-star experience that we can go, yeah, all right, let's try and do that. Let's pick You know, if we can't make the Beatles playing live, what if we did do live music for people in their Airbnb? What if, you know, and that sort of asked, that sort of stumped up a lot of questions that suddenly started to make that experience better. And this is a digital company, you know. So
yes, exactly. Yeah. So look, and I think what's really interesting there is it's going to be different for different types of brands.
Yes.
But ultimately, underpinning it is that desire to achieve best in breed. So, and I'm not one for always focusing on competition as well. So if you're in a particular market segment, every market segment these days is crowded, it's competitive. I think we can get consumed with looking at what our competitors are doing and trying to do one-upmanship. I think the really important thing is use that energy, take that focus and put it on your customers. That'll be the ultimate guiding light, if you like. I think at the end of the day, whether you're selling shoes or selling consulting services as a big four, that's got to be your focus. The experience is going to be different, but ultimately,
And I think this sort of leads me to the last discussion point that I wanted to run through with you today, because I think about myself as a, you know, as a consultant and a marketer, and I think about that 11-star experience, and you can't unfortunately go past the point that part of that 11-star experience is going to be delivering results for your customers. You know, it is, you know, you could do all the, you could, you know, take them to an Airbnb that's orbiting the planet and play the, you know, have a live Beatles performance, you know, in front of them. But if, at the end of the day, if you're not delivering results, you know, you're probably not, they're probably not going to stay your client that much longer. Right at the start, you mentioned a focus on bottom line growth. Why is that? And this is probably a really, really obvious answer, but I'll still ask it anyway. So obvious question, but why is that important? Why is that so important for marketers to be aware of?
Well, I think if you, as a marketer, if you go into the boardroom and start talking about soft measures and don't really connect that to what the pressures are on a board or an executive team, you're not going to have a very productive conversation.
Yeah.
Ultimately, one of the issues we face as marketers is still being thought of as a cost base rather than as a revenue driver. So, but if you change that conversation, if you switch that up into a language that they understand and really think about where do the two meet, where do the customer needs meet, and where do the company needs meet and the brand needs meet, if you get into that sweet spot, then it's a really fruitful conversation around how you can drive profitable growth for the business. As marketers, we're always balancing also short-termism, which is another pressure on senior marketers about getting results now. What's the return on investment? What are the metrics like on that latest campaign? Yeah. I think we've got to balance that also and keep some in our pocket for long-term objectives to say we need to focus on this now, but ultimately this is where we want to get to. So having those meaningful conversations with your executive team and board, if relevant, are just vital so that marketers actually have that credibility to say we are a vital cog within the C-suite ecosystem.
It's funny because I've had that conversation a lot in the last 6 months when customers go, you know, how much should we be spending on marketing? And my answer back to that is another question, which is, well, how much money do you want to make? You know, and literally last week I presented to a client, which is that have a very pure, it's a very pure marketing business. That's, you know, they are just, you could argue they're 99% marketing. And we'd gone through all the figures and said, you know, on average, somewhere every month, you make somewhere between $9 and $12 for every dollar that you invest in marketing. And my point to them was that if you want to make more money, you just invest more money in marketing. And yes, we've got to make sure that that ratio stays the same as we spend more money. But really, you want to make more money, you want to make more profit, your cost base is staying the same. It's overinvest in marketing. But to your point, I see so many marketers that don't even understand how much the company is making. I sat in front of a C-suite of lawyers, and none of them had any idea what the company was making or what their targets were for that year. It's amazing how many people don't really have their head around those numbers.
Yeah, and look, for marketers, that's really important, because if you're part of the leadership team or aspire to be, having that sort of fiscal strength and focus on bottom line is only going to improve your own credibility and focus on what matters to the company. And this can all be tied back, going back to the early discussion around brand purpose. So if our purpose is to deliver XYZ, we're going to do that, but we're going to do it in a way that actually means that we're a sustainable brand. And by sustainable, I mean profitable, because we can only continue to exist as a brand if we, in fact, look after that healthy bottom line. And there's, to your point earlier as well, there's a famous phrase along the lines of, not everything that counts can be counted, not everything that can be counted counts. Yeah. And I think that we've got to measure the right things and actually question what the statistics tell us.
Okay, last three questions to wrap up.
Sure.
Obviously, in your experience and some of the brands that you've worked with, you must somewhere have some favorites out there. So I'm interested to hear about, again, not necessarily ones that you've worked with, but I'm interested to hear about brands that you admire, that you look at and go, you know what, those guys are hitting the nail on the head every time.
Yeah, I look at, I can give you two quick examples. One is a local leather goods manufacturer in Australia, Bellroy. Now, Bellroy have, considered to be a bit of a niche play, but they've grown successfully because they developed an approach to storytelling that is meaningful to their customers. And I love the way they've done it, because they've been able to maintain a certain quality about their product and attraction to their product as a premium product, and yet reach a diverse audience through their particular products. On a larger scale, if I look at German skincare giant like Beiersdorf, and they make Nivea and all sorts of other products. What I like about Beiersdorf is that they do a lot of online and social listening. So they're constantly actively listening to their customers in a competitive, crowded marketplace that's so vital, because they're able to shape their products accordingly. Yeah. They're able to maintain agile and responsive. And, you know, when we hear a lot about agility, et cetera, from marketers these days, that's what it essentially means. It means being able to respond to different customer needs as they evolve. So, I mean, they're two quick examples off the top of my head that I would say, from different perspectives and from different size and scale, doing it well.
Is there any out there that you, I'll ask you the alternative question, is there any out there that you look at and you think they've lost the plot, or that they could be doing better? And for fear, you don't have to answer for fear of incrimination that you'll never get them as a client.
No, that's fine. I talk about this in my book as well, so that's probably okay with it. Obviously, we all know about the VW emissions scandal. Yeah. And that's, I suppose that's a prime example of putting profit above everything else. So that's a company that really at the leadership end of the spectrum lost its way in terms of brand purpose. They focused primarily on being the largest. Their ambition was to be the largest automaker in the world, I think, by 2019.
Yeah.
So when you've got an aggressive growth strategy like that, everything, you're going to cut corners. Yeah. You're going to do things that really aren't true to purpose. So I think the purpose, going back to that, has got to be so centered on what is sustainable growth and what is true to your own ethics and values as well. So that's one I highlight in the book, is one that's been really an area where brands don't want to get into cutting corners, if you like, with their customers. Yeah.
penultimate question. You've written one book. You've been with Norman Disney and Young quite a while. You've just started a new role, advisory role, haven't you?
That's right, yeah. So working with the Australian Marketing Institute, board advisory role. And that's focused on really the professional development of marketers within Australia. So there is, and a lot of people don't know this, but there is actually certification for marketers, so yeah. CPM, Certified Practicing Marketer. So much like the CPA for accountants, the idea is that a CPM becomes the pinnacle of marketing prowess, if you like. So it really embodies the best of marketing. So to have a CPM after your name is really showing internally your own organisational leadership that you're a marketing leader and have that respect and gone through an accreditation process.
Have you got another book inside you, do you think?
Well, I think everyone's got a book inside them. Do I have another one? I think you know, one of the benefits of having a journalism background is to be comfortable writing. Yeah. I think I've started to think a lot about trust within brands and, you know, the importance of that. Yeah. And by that I mean from a consumer and customer perspective. Obviously there's a lot of talk about that, the Engelmann trust barometer that yourself and a lot of your audience would know about continues to show that people are losing faith in a lot of brands. So I think that's an area that requires further exploration, but we'll wait and see what the next 12 to 18 months.
On a side note, I find a lot of journalists at the moment writing fiction. Actually, I've read a couple of books in last year by Australian journalists who obviously decided to pick the pen up and I don't know if that's something that's happened recently or you know they've
a lot of journalists or ex-journalists are also ghostwriters. Okay. So a lot of books that you see in bookstores who are supposedly penned by certain celebrities or not. So there's always been that going on in terms of a ghostwriting perspective. But I think most journalists, you know, are closet fiction writers at heart. So,
that begs the question then, if you were going to write a fiction book, what genre would it be about then, Rick?
I have some interesting corporate tales that I could tell. I think it would not only be a book, I think it would be a Netflix series. So who knows?
Yeah, and you'd probably have to do it under an assumed name as well.
Yeah.
All right. Well, last question. If anybody wants to come and talk to you, if they've got some questions, what's the best way of finding you?
Yeah, look, online, as you mentioned, I'm not really huge on Twitter, but always active on LinkedIn. It's a great way to reach me. And, of course, I've got a marketing book website, so marketingwithpurpose.solutions. That has a contact page as well. So if anyone wants to reach me, they're probably the two best ways to get in touch.
And how much is the book, just so people know?
$24.95. Yeah. And look, that's hard copy. It is available on Google Play and iTunes.
Cool. Awesome. Mate, thank you very much for your insights today and your ideas and your suggestions. And I hope people will get some value out of that. But really appreciate your time today.
No, thank you, Simon. I hope there's been some pearls of wisdom amongst my readers. So thanks for the time.
Thank you, mate.
Take care. Cheers.
We hope you enjoyed the 55th episode of the Paper Planes podcast, stroke the Simon Dell Show, now the Paper Planes podcast. Hope you learned a lot from Rick. And look, we really appreciate you tuning in and we look forward to catching up with you next week.